Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show features my inspiring conversation with animal behaviorist and autism advocate, Temple Grandin. We discuss Temple's childhood growing up on the autism spectrum and how her unique perspective as a visual learner has informed her views on how we can improve the educational system, as well as advocating for the humane treatment of animals. This episode is thought-provoking and insightful, and I hope that it will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Today's guest, Temple Grandin, candidly admits that she thinks differently than most people. As a visual learner, Temple thinks and stores memories as very specific pictures. When most people think about a school, they may imagine a generic school building. However, Temple can see every school she's ever attended by retrieving those visual memories, those pictures, from what she calls her personal Google in her brain. Temple not only thinks differently, she also experiences the world differently. Temple is on the autism spectrum and was nonverbal for the first 4 years of her life. In the early 1950s, doctors actually suggested that Temple be institutionalized. But luckily, Temple's mom advocated for her and found unique ways to get Temple mentors, tutors, and teachers who could help Temple get interested in school and learning. After being kicked out of her school for throwing a book at a bully, Temple attended a boarding school in the Northeast. While there, she met Dr. Carlock, a former NASA scientist turned science teacher. Dr. Carlock saw Temple's potential and encouraged her to apply her visual thinking as a pathway towards a goal. Later, while staying on her aunt's cattle farm in Arizona, Temple noticed how the farmers calmed down cattle by placing them in a squeeze box. Intrigued by its potential use elsewhere, Temple made a squeeze box of her own. Temple's hug machine worked just as she'd imagined and successfully calmed her anxieties. While studying as a master's student at Arizona State University, Temple pioneered the use of squeeze boxes on cattle farms and in slaughterhouses to ensure the humane treatment of cattle in the meat industry. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Temple Grandin, recorded live on Zoom for our Freedom Forum video series. I am so honored today that we have such an esteemed guest as a scientist, a professor, an animal behaviorist, but most passionately for me as an educator, Temple Grandin is a spokesperson, an activist, and an ally for those on the autism spectrum. And so throughout this wonderful interview, we're going to learn some personal anecdotes about Temple, but she's also going to share her life in the field of the things that she's been able to do that have truly changed the world. She's about getting things done. So Temple, let's start there. You like to get things done. You don't want to pontificate. You want to get things done. And where does that ability to make change come from?
Well, I'm an extreme visual thinker. And I think that might have something to do with it because everything I think about is a picture. So let's just think of something simple like driving to the airport. I always leave an extra hour because I'm visualizing, well, maybe there'll be a traffic jam out on the freeway. You see, those things are not abstract. And there's different kinds of thinking. I'm what's called an object visualizer. And I first talked about this in my book, Thinking in Pictures, before I learned exactly what an object visualizer was. It's a person that thinks completely in pictures, and that is how I think. And I discovered when I was in my mid-30s that most people, they don't think in pictures. Now, when I write, I see the pictures of the things I'm going to write. You've got the object visualizers like me, and then you've got the mathematical pattern thinkers. Think music and math. Those are going to be your computer programs. But I like to get things done. I like real stuff that's not abstract. Because what I've learned about verbal thinking, there's a tendency to have an abstract policy or something like that. But they don't think about how do I actually implement that policy.
Temple, I appreciate how your practical experience is a part of how you process and you learn and ultimately practice. But I'd love for you to talk about those early years. I understand that until you were about 3 or 4 years old, you were nonverbal. So can you tell our audience about those early years before you were speaking?
I can remember the frustration of not being able to talk. Very, very frustrating. Did not have full speech till 4. And when the grown-ups talked really fast, I just wanted to gibberish. But I got into very good speech therapy by age 2.5. The other thing that was done with me when I was started to show art ability, I was on visual thinker around 2nd and 3rd grade. My mother always encouraged it. Take the thing the kid's good at, build on it. See, kids that are on the autism spectrum are often really good at one thing and really bad at something else. And mother built on my strengths. But I would just draw the same horse head over and over again. And she'd say, well, why don't you draw the stable or draw the saddle, draw the entire horse? You want to broaden it. The other big thing that gets mixed up is the difference between an interest, that'd be dogs or horses or cars, for example, and a skill. They're two different things, an ability and a skill and an interest. You know, for people on the autism spectrum, vehicles are a very common interest. So if the child is interested in that, let's read about them. Let's do math with airplanes and take that interest and broaden it. Now, I'm also very much an associative thinker. And just last week, I went to a great STEM program in Salt Lake City that the state's actually paying for. And I watched an autistic 12-year-old come in there, and he totally got into 3D printing. And it took 1.5 hours to print out a little tiny plastic airplane. And he was completely fixated on this, but he also acted a lot less autistic because other people there also had a shared interest in how the 3D printer worked. See, I like seeing that kid get involved in it because he's got to do the 3D printer with other people there in the maker lab.
Temple, what's so well documented is your mother's advocacy. She was an advocate for you in schools before there was even advocates in schools. And what she fought for was mentorship and teacher accountability and therapists. So can you talk about how important it was for your mother to be your advocate?
I was the kind of kid that in the 50s, they usually just put away in the institution. But then you have a lot of kids that are autistic where there's no speech delay. That used to be called Asperger's syndrome. And a lot of granddads have come up to me and told me that they're finding out they're autistic when the kids get diagnosed. Right here, I'm holding Ashley Vance's book about Elon Musk. And I've got some yellow post-it notes that have been in there since the book was published, where I marked the pages where I thought Elon Musk was autistic. Now I can say it because it came out on Saturday Night Live and told everybody.
I love when you do presentations, you often talk about Elon Musk and Mozart, Einstein, and people that you believe are on the autism spectrum and this continuum. So let's talk about that. You're in great company.
This is the problem with autism. When I was a young child at 3, I looked really severe. And the first doctor I went to, she recommended a speech therapy school that where 2 teachers just did it in their house. There was a lot of emphasis on learning how to wait and take turns. I had a wonderful 3rd grade teacher. Then I had my science teacher in high school. And for the first 3 years I was in high school, I didn't do any studying. In fact, I got kicked out of a regular high school for throwing a book at a girl who teased me in 9th grade. And then the last year that I was there, Mr. Carlock came and he gave me interesting science projects. So now I was motivated to study because studying now is a pathway to a goal.
You know, what I've loved about your work is you always pay an ode to the 50s. It taught you manners. It taught you how to be self-reliant. Your mom made you get internships and work over the summer.
We were learning work skills. I mean, we were selling candy for charity around the neighborhood. And in the 50s, manners were taught in a really systematic way. And they used what I call teachable moments. So if I stuck my finger in the mashed potatoes and licked it, mother didn't scream, no. She just said, use the fork. Other people think that's disgusting when you do that. She'd calmly tell you what to do. And if I went over to the next door neighbor's house, the other mom would do the same thing. I'm seeing too many kids today, smart kids with a label, never gone shopping. Mm. I was shopping by the time I was 7 and 8 years old.
Temple, I'd like you to speak about your middle school years. You know, middle school is a tough time for anyone, but sadly you were bullied. And I think that bullying is what led to you throwing the book and eventually getting expelled. So can you tell our audience about those really tough middle school years?
A lot of kids are bullied in elementary school. And the reason I wasn't is Mrs. Deitch explained to the other kids that I had a disability, but it was not visible like crutches or a wheelchair, and that they needed to be helping me, not torturing me. I've now learned that's called peer-mediated intervention, and that helped me. High school was just the worst. And then when I went to the special school, I was still bullied. I was called tape recorder, because I always repeated the same phrases. I was called bones, because I was skinny. And the only places I was not bullied was shared interests. Riding horses, decorating plastic model horses with my roommate, and electronics lab and model rocket club. Because the students that participated in those activities were not the bullies. Friends through shared interests. I cannot emphasize that enough.
Temple, I'd like for you to talk about your mentor, the esteemed science teacher, Mr. Carlock, who formerly worked at NASA, who really encouraged you to expand on your idea of creating a hug machine. Can you tell us about that influence with that incredible teacher of yours?
He encouraged me with that because I watched cattle go in the squeeze chute, and I noticed sometimes cattle calm down and squeak in the squeeze chute, and He suggested that I build it and then also do a little experiment, which I did as an undergraduate thesis. Now, one of the things that really holds back a visual thinker like me is I can't do algebra. Absolutely can't. I took a biomedical engineering class. I had to drop it because I couldn't do the math. But this brings up a really important thing about engineering. There's the industrial design side of engineering. That's me. And then there's the more mathematical side of engineering. And when I was out working on these great big meat plants, it's very interesting when they build the whole factory right from the ground up, how the labor is divided up on who designs stuff. I worked with a lot of people that own a metal fabrication shop and have 20 patents, and they do what I call the clever engineering department. Then you have the parts of the plant that are more abstract. That's done by the engineer with the college degree, but you still have to have the clever engineering department. And I'm getting concerned that our education system is screening out a lot of the people like me.
I love that you're an advocate for diversified learning. For
Absolutely. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, I present the science that shows that these different kinds of thinking actually really do exist. There's science. And I'm an object visualizer who looks at things in pictures. And then you have the mathematical mind that thinks more in patterns. And there's scientific research now that supports that. And an extreme object visualizer is not going to be also an extreme mathematician. And there's lots and lots of people kind of in the middle, but we need the different kinds of minds.
Temple, what I find fascinating is how you have identified that you are a visual learner. And you often refer to your brain as your individual Google. As you're searching for data, you search for these photos and these images, these visual images in your brain. So can you tell our audience about what it means to be a visual learner?
I'm what's called a bottom-up thinker, where a highly verbal thinker will have an abstract policy, but no idea how to implement it. But to make a bottom-up thinker good at thinking, I have to have lots of experiences. You've got to get out and experience lots of stuff to fill the database. And when I got to be about 40, that's when I thought, boy, I can really think really good now because I filled the database. And I've had parents tell me that when they got their kid off the couch and got them out doing a job, they said, well, he just blossomed because you see you're filling the database.
You said something earlier that just made me very sad. And when you were born and in that early age of not being verbal, that an option at that time was to institutionalize children.
Well, the thing that was bad in the 50s is that the kids that didn't know how to talk, they usually just institutionalized. And the more Asperger type of kids, they usually ended up getting jobs. But today I'm seeing too many smart kids held back.
Can we talk about relationships then? I know that sometimes on the autism spectrum, that social interaction could be difficult or a struggle. And was it like that for you?
Well, I can share interests, I have problems with some of the chit-chat, and part of the reason is I can't follow it, and there's kind of a rhythm of conversation I still can't do, and part of the problem is I can't get the timing right. People said, well, Temple interrupts during interviews. I know I do that, because if I was a computer, I'm only an Intel 286 with a really small working memory, but I've got the cloud for graphics storage.
Temple, as a teacher, I really appreciate how candid and honest you've been about your own personal overload. When you have that sensory overload, it often can make you feel that you're shutting down. And so a lot of young people who are on the autism spectrum also have that same sensory overload. So can you tell the audience, specifically teachers, maybe some signs that we can look out for?
These sensory issues vary a whole lot, but there's some people that need sensory breaks. Another big problem I had was anxiety, and that was horrible through my 20s because I found out later on that my fear center was 3 times bigger than normal. And what the medication did is it calmed down my fear circuits. That's what it did.
You know, and I appreciate you talking about medication. You know, a lot of our parents, educators, teachers may also be on medication, and you've always been an advocate in moderation to be conservative, but that it lessened your anxiety. You said you used to...
Well, I'd be so fearful, like, oh, I was just paralyzed, and way too many meds are given out to little kids, way too much. But then I know other people, especially visual thinkers like me, who are a little bit of Prozac. It's made all the difference in the world. And one of the mistakes that's made with antidepressants is taking too high a dose. I did the DIPVAT projects that were so new before I had meds, but then I don't know, my health was getting worse and worse and worse because of the constant anxiety. And then I went on a little dose of antidepressant and it like throttled back my nervous system.
There's not many people in the world that can say that Claire Dane played them. The film that is about your life, Temple Grandin, was nominated for 15 Emmys, won 7, and was a window into people's homes and lives and conversations.
Rocking, spinning, rolling on the floor, flapping.
Well, I think spinning is good. And rolling, too. And being held by another person is scary, but rolling or being held by surfaces produces the calming effect that ordinary children get from a hug.
How old's your child?
Well, I don't have children. No, I'm autistic. And I need the sensation of being hugged. And I've developed a machine that I get into and hugs me, and I'm different afterwards. I'm more social.
And what was it like for you to suddenly be in people's homes, at their dinner tables, and implementing educational reform in schools?
Well, I figure it's a responsibility. Claire Danes kind of became me. The movie shows visual thinking completely accurately. I'm a person who likes to get things done. Get the mechanical classes back into high school, shop and welding. I've worked with 2 people that definitely would be labeled autistic today. They were saved by a single welding class in high school. And one of them owns a very large metal fabrication company and he sells his stuff all over the world. You see, what I'm proposing is they get exposed to enough different things.
Speaking of being exposed, your mother had the insight to give you 2 choices. You could go for a week or a summer to visit your aunt in Arizona who owned a ranch. And let's talk about that.
Hadn't gone to my aunt's ranch, I probably wouldn't be in the cattle industry. See, another thing that was an advantage in the cattle industry is you can do engineering without an engineering degree. And in the meat industry, there were people just working in maintenance and they were designing whole entire plants and their title might be draftsman. But they were doing a lot more than just doing the drafting, I can tell you that.
But you came up with this great cliche. You said, nature is cruel, but we don't have to be. So,
well, that's right. I mean, when the hyenas like rip your guts out, eat on you while you're still alive, that is not very nice. Yeah, we don't have to be doing that kind of stuff. You know, so we've got to give the animals that we use food a decent life. One of the things that's in that is the animal needs to have some positive emotions and have a life worth living.
What I love about what you've been able to do is you have great empathy and compassion for the animals because you believe that they too are visual thinkers.
Animals are sensory-based thinkers. In fact, my student Megan Corrigan just finished up a really interesting study. She took a plastic playset, so she set it up in an alcove in the stable and walked young, horror-broken Colts and Phillies by it 15 times. And she looked at, did they put their head up? Did they blow their nostrils out a little bit? Did they stop? And when they first saw it, they would do that. And then they would habituate. So now you've got Colts and Phillies totally habituated to this little plastic playset. Now you rotate it 90 degrees. It became something new. That playset became a new thing when you turned it because it looked different. But that shows right there that a horse is a visual thinker, and it would explain some of the spooking and bucking people off that seems to happen for no reason.
But I think with the way you process and your sensitivity, you ultimately had empathy for cows who were scared. If there was a flag that was waving or if there was a piece of a fence that was teetering.
I noticed they'd stop at a shadow. They'd stop, there was a coat hanging over the side of a chute. Other people hadn't noticed that, because if you think in words, you might have a hard time imagining how an animal could even have a thought. Well, when you think in pictures, I don't think in words. It's obvious to me the animal thinks. It also was obvious to me to look at what cattle were looking at. And something as simple as taking the coat off the fence solved the problem.
When you started working in an industry that was probably more male-dominated on these ranches and working with livestock, do you feel that you were embraced with your new methodology and the way that you were bringing sensitivity to this industry?
Being a woman was the biggest barrier in the 70s. And most of the trouble I had was at the middle management and the foreman level. The other thing I learned to do was to sell my work. I'd show people off what my work was like. And I've been having a lot of discussions with employers that said we need to get rid of the regular interview stuff. People with autism don't do well with that, and just have them come in and show over, give them a programming project, and let's see how they do.
As a fellow million-mile flyer, you and I zigzag the country, and I often have spoken in school districts where you had just been, and you are making education better. So what are some of the things that you like to leave as a takeaway? Because I know you're realist and pragmatic. What do you want schools to do better?
Putting all the hands-on classes back in. Because some of these kids that are different, that's where they excel. Art class, music class, theater. Now, I wasn't interested in acting in the play, but I made sets and costumes for every single elementary school, high school, and college. But that's something that can turn into a career.
I also love that you fight fiercely to get rid of stigmas and stereotypes and shame.
I really like the Paralympics and the fact that it's in the same venues and everything. Because you're showing what people can do. I don't like all these disabilities being lumped together because the kind of problems I have are very different than a blind person or somebody in a wheelchair.
What was it like for you when you suddenly had a diagnosis? And I know it didn't come till years later. Did that help or hurt? And what does a diagnosis mean to you and ultimately to others?
Well, I'm concerned with the work side of things, the diagnosis holding them back. I'm seeing a lot of parents that can't let go. They don't think their kid can learn to drive. They don't think their kid can learn to hold a job or even shop at the supermarket. But where a diagnosis helps is the older person with relationships. Let's discuss driving. I got this little prop right here, and this is what I learned to drive on. It's an exact replica of it. It had three on the tree, a horrible clutch, and I started in the horse pasture. It's going to take longer. You're going to have to spend a lot more time learning to drive the vehicle until you touch traffic. And sometimes in the driver's ed programs, they shove them into it way too quickly. It's going to take a lot more time practicing driving. But if I hadn't learned to drive, that would have really limited my work in the livestock industry.
When we think about the squeeze chute and how that became your high school science project with your hug machine, can you talk about why folks on the autism spectrum often need that intimacy?
It's just deep pressure. And a lot of people say, well, I go to the dentist and they put that heavy apron on you for the x-rays. And a lot of people kind of like that apron. Mm-hmm. That's just an example of deep pressure. And there are some people that have autism that that really like that that pressure. And there's others that don't. See, this is where sensory things are very, very variable. Also, by using the squeeze machine, which I could control. See, that's another important thing. Then I got to where I could tolerate people hugging me.
When you talked about your peer mediation in elementary school, what I have learned is some of the best learning I have learned as an educator is with relationships with people who are on the spectrum. I want to tell you about two specifically, and I'd love for you to give them some advice.
Okay.
The first one, his name is Jaden. He is a Freedom Writer author ambassador, and he just graduated from high school. And Jaden was taken from his class and put often in a resource. And it led to teasing and bullying. And he didn't understand what his diagnosis was. He called it ass, A-S-S, like ass, burgers, like the burgers you eat at McDonald's. Oh, so yeah. He called Asperger's ass burgers, which I thought was delightful. And now that he's on the other side of school, what I love that he's become is an advocate for not making kids feel different and be different. So if you could tell Jaden, who's now just beginning his academic career in higher education, what would be a recommendation for someone who has Asperger's?
I'll make a recommendation. I'd tell every student, doesn't matter what, whether they have autism or they're autistic or whatever. If you get in trouble in a class, let's say you fail a quiz, do something about it right away. The other thing is do lots of different things. I can't emphasize that enough. So you can start doing things that will lead to a job. I think there needs to be a gradual transition from the world of school to the world of work. And I've students that are in the pipeline right now, I recommend two real jobs before they graduate from high school. And one of the big problems I'm seeing for autistic kids is a differentiation is not being made where a simple job like maybe pushing carts in the grocery store is a training job. That'd be a training job for me. And for some other individual, it might be a suitable career. And that distinction is not being made. Because what you don't want to have is a sudden transition where you're out of school, now what do I do? But getting those kind of experiences before you graduate, I can't emphasize that enough.
The other question I have for you is a Freedom Writer teacher. Her name is Carol Ann. And when I met her and I discovered that she also is on the autism spectrum, I invited her to a teacher training, and she said, "I can't come. I'm not a teacher." And I said, "Carol Ann, you very much are, because you're going to come to this training and teach us about the autism spectrum." So for those that are not in school, their parents, their adults, what can they give to society?
I had another good mentor. His name was Jim Uhl. He was a former Marine Corps captain starting a small steel and concrete business to build cattle handling facilities. And he seeked me out. And he was another very important mentor. And I had a problem on one job. The customer wasn't satisfied. And he says, "No, you don't give up. You just got to keep on going." He was another super important mentor. And there was another former Army officer that was the superintendent of the local Swift meatpacking plant, who was another person who was extremely helpful. And it's interesting, they were both former military officers. You know, it's sort of a no-nonsense, get-it-done mentality that they have that I seem to resonate with. And those people really helped me. You never know where you're going to find mentors. But Jim was attracted to me because he'd seen my drawings. And he needed somebody to design projects for him to build. For 10 years, we built jobs together. Then I went away to Illinois, and the cattle industry got less in Arizona. He went off and did commercial construction stuff.
As a former Time 100 Person of the Year, you were in the heroes category. I'd like you to give advice to the 4-year-old Temple, who was learning to speak, was going to go to school shortly. What advice would Temple now, with her PhD and her books and her advocacy, tell a 4-year-old Temple if you were a 4-year-old Temple's mentor?
Let's get that kid out there doing things. We got kids today that are growing up, they've never used a tool. They aren't doing enough just hands-on on stuff. And I went to Maker Faire about 5 years ago, and the big hit there was large cardboard boxes that things like washing machines and refrigerators came in, and the kids were making stuff out of them. I looked up Michelangelo. Two things helped him. He was exposed to the art. You see, this whole thing of exposure to careers is really, really important. Every church was commissioning all this art, and he'd be walking around looking at that. He also grew up in a family that were stone cutters, so he got introduced to the tools at an early age.
Sadly, Temple, as someone on the autism spectrum, you were bullied in school and often sent away. And what makes me really disheartened is that teachers, administrators, and even principals did not intervene or advocate on your behalf. Luckily, your mother did. So for parents out there, what could they learn from these lessons when a parent is an advocate?
Now, fortunately, at the time, mother was working as a journalist, looking at special schools. So she'd been to a whole bunch of special schools as a journalism project doing a TV show for NPR. And she picked out three schools. She let me choose. Mother always believed in giving some choices. And the school I went to had a farm. They did lots of hands-on things. They had horses to ride. And that was really helpful.
Temple, you mentioned that a lot of people on the autism spectrum often fixate. And you talk about taking that fixation and broadening horizons and doing something good both professionally, personally, and academically. So can you elaborate about the importance of using fixation for good?
Okay, let's say I've already discussed the difference between an interest or a fixation. That might be cars or something like that. From a skill, which might be mechanics, visual thinking, mathematics. And those skills need to be developed. And you can often use the thing that the child's interested in as the vehicle for teaching something like reading. But what I want to do is take that fixation and broaden it. So let's say for me, it was just doing a single horse head over and over again. Well, mother said, well, let's draw the stable. Let's talk about a place you might ride a horse to. You see how I'm making an associative link back to the horse, but I'm broadening it.
Temple, I appreciate how you pay homage to your mother. She found the perfect mentors for you, the perfect therapist for you. She sent you to the ranch to embolden you in your life's work. And so tell us a little bit more about the advocacy that your mother played in your development.
She knew, she was always stretching me to do new things, not throwing me in the deep end of the pool, but she had a very good sense of how to stretch me and get me out exposed to new things. Because as a bottom-up thinker, in order to have a lot of knowledge, I got to see a lot of stuff to put information into my database that's in my brain. I have to read things, I have to see things, I have to do things to do that.
Well, I think for our audience, we live in a world where there's a lot of bottom-up thinkers. There's a lot of people who are on the spectrum and this continuum. So for our audience, whether they are a student, a parent, an educator, or just a citizen of the world, what is your advice for us to be inclusive and accepting of anyone who thinks differently than ourselves?
First of all, you have to be aware that different thinking exists. When I was in my 20s, I thought everybody thought pictures the way I did. I didn't know that verbal thinking even existed. They can be complementary skills. Okay, right now I'm working on a book on visual thinking with my super verbal, super good co-author, Betsy Lerner. And the way Betsy rearranges my stuff, it's absolutely wonderful. But she couldn't get stuff, make up some of the stuff I do or find some of the stuff I do.
Temple, as a fellow educator, I love encouraging our audience to do a homework assignment at the end of our podcast. So my homework assignment today is simple. I want them to learn about you and more about the autism spectrum. To do so, they can watch the incredible Emmy Award-winning film about you. Or they can pick up one of your books. You are a voracious writer and scientist. So can you tell us about some of the books that you could encourage our audience to pick up and read?
Thinking in Pictures is my autobiography, and I just did a new afterword in it that has some of my ideas of education. Then I've got The Way I See It. This book is a lot of little short chapters and really great for teachers working with the younger kids. So those two of my, you know, really important autism books. And then I also have lots of livestock and animal behavior books. And I already talked about The Outdoor Scientist and Calling All Minds, because we need to get kids out doing things. You learn from your mistakes. I had a teacher ask me, what would happen to a kid's self-esteem? They cut it wrong and the snowflake fell apart. I said, you get another piece of paper and you just try again. And then if that doesn't work, you can look it up on YouTube. I'm sure you'll find directions there. But I think we have some teachers now growing up in such a verbal world that they're worried about a kid's self-esteem over a paper snowflake fell apart.
We're going to allow our audience to fail forward, to take risks, and to not be as fragile as that paper snowflake. Temple, you have just been exquisite. I can't wait to read more, to learn more, and I thank you for enlightening our audience.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been absolutely wonderful talking to everybody, and I just want to see kids that are different just get out there and be what they can be. And we need all the different kinds of minds, and they have complementary skills when they work together.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Temple Grandin, for sharing with us her experiences as a renowned autism activist and advocate, and for giving us a glimpse into her unique perspective on the world. My dear listeners, may each of us encourage students to find their path to success, no matter their way of thinking. May we all look for ways to create more inclusive spaces for all. And in Temple's honor, may we remember that while nature may be cruel, we don't have to. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.